Good evening and welcome to the July 2026 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. We begin tonight with a conversation about Mental Health America of California and their LIVE program. LIVE is LGBTQ plus inclusivity, visibility, and empowerment. And it's a program of changemakers that celebrates the LGBTQ plus diversity and creates a more inclusive world where LGBT community members can live authentically. And then in the second half of our hour, Finn Dearhart shares a conversation with Charlie Stevens, a queer non-binary author and bookshop owner in Oregon. Their debut novel, A Wounded Deer Leaps Highest, was published back in 2024 and was longlisted for the Center for Fiction's 2024 First Novel Prize and a finalist for the Oregon Book Awards Ken Casey Award for Fiction. So stay with us. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, July 26th, 2026. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of July 26th, 2026. The United Kingdom's Department of Education has published updated guidance for schools that critics argue will put transgender and gender non-conforming children in that country at greater risk. The new guidance, set to take effect this September, dictates that schools must not allow children into toilets or changing rooms designated for the opposite biological sex, even if that student has socially transitioned. The policy follows a Supreme Court ruling that the legal definition of women is based on biological sex. The guidance also advises against staff and teachers supporting a children's social transition without extensive hurdles, including active parental involvement. Advocates warn that this amounts to a forced outing policy that could endanger transgender children in unsupportive homes. While the guidance does allow for single-use restrooms as an alternative, there is no actual requirement for schools to provide them. Critics, including the Good Law Project, emphasize that the new rule fails to properly accommodate the needs of transgender children and will ultimately compromise their safety, dignity, and privacy. A gay former FBI employee, David Maltinsky, was fired over displaying a Progress Pride flag. He's asked a federal judge in Washington, D.C. to reject the Trump administration's efforts to dismiss key parts of his lawsuit. Maltinsky is also seeking to obtain official internal records and testimony regarding the decision to end his 16-year career with the Bureau. His attorneys argue that he sufficiently alleged discrimination and retaliation under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Maltinsky was fired from the FBI by Director Kash Patel just 3 weeks before graduating from the FBI Academy, allegedly for exercising poor judgment by displaying political signage. The signage in question was a Progress Pride flag that the FBI had previously flown outside its Los Angeles office and given to Maltinsky. Despite his supervisor and legal counsel previously stating the display was entirely permissible, Maltinsky was terminated. The Justice Department moved to dismiss the claims, arguing the flag did not expressly identify his sexual orientation. However, Maltinsky's attorneys contend that the firing of someone for displaying a pride flag betrays hostility toward their protected characteristic, and he likened the firing to a Jewish person for wearing a Star of David. They argued in court to allow the discovery to proceed immediately to prevent memories from fading and documents from being lost. And also this month, the Trump administration has formally stripped away federal protections for LGBTQ plus children and foster care, a move that advocates warn will severely harm a highly vulnerable population. Under Health and Human Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Department of Health and Human Services rescinded a Biden-era rule designed to ensure LGBTQ plus foster youth are placed in supportive homes and protected from conversion therapy. Research consistently shows that LGBTQ plus youth are overrepresented in the foster care system and face significantly worse outcomes, including higher rates of suicide attempts and homelessness. The previous rule required child welfare agencies receiving federal funding to make specifically trained, supportive placements available for LGBTQ plus children. It also created a formal process for reporting mistreatment. The Trump administration argues that the rule risked discouraging religious families from becoming foster parents during a nationwide shortage of licensed homes. However, former officials and advocates argue that the rescission sends a clear message that the safety and identity of LGBTQ plus youth matter less to the objectives of adults. Without a federal standard, protections for these children will now depend entirely on geography and the willingness of individual states and agencies to maintain supportive policies. And in Idaho, a Methodist conference that was scheduled to take place in the city of Boise next year will have to find a new venue as its members voted to leave the state out of concerns for the safety of transgender and non-binary participants. The United Methodist Church held its annual Oregon-Idaho conference at the Cathedral of the Rockies in Boise, and it was supposed to return to the same church in 2027, but the state's transphobic climate has gotten so bad that the majority of the council voted, 52-48, to change the venue for next year. During the conversation and debate, members named serious concerns about the safety, racism, anti-transgender rhetoric and action, and the lived realities of people of color, immigrants, queer and trans siblings, and others who are targeted by hate, laws, policies, and public speech. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. The mission of Mental Health America, California, is to assist and encourage communities, families, and individuals to experience hope, wellness, and recovery from mental health and substance use disorder issues. The people and communities they serve include sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression subcommunities. To tell us more about how they support local organizations is Anthony Garibay-Menya and Elijah Joseph. Welcome to you both.
Hello, Greg.
Hi, Greg. Thank you for having us.
Well, it's going to be fantastic to learn a little bit more about the important work that you're doing. But before we get to that, Anthony, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your role with the program.
Excellent. Thank you, Greg. My name is Anthony Garibay-Menya. My pronouns are he, him, his. And I oversee the LIVE program, which is our LGBTQ plus inclusivity, visibility, and empowerment program of Mental Health America of California. And I specifically oversee our statewide operations and partner network throughout the state of California. We currently have 14 nonprofit organizations that we partner with. And I also oversee advocacy efforts on behalf of all 14 partners throughout the state of California.
Fantastic. How did you arrive at this work? Has this always been part of who you are?
So I've always had a passion for advocacy, being a part of the queer community. And then also, I am a retired veteran, a retired Navy chief, and I know just through growing up in a small town in Northern California in Lassen County, the struggles of needing to be closeted at times, just, because afraid of fear. And then also my adult professional life, a little bit similar, just, living a double life and just being very conscious about like who I share my personal story with when it comes to my professional career. Just, out of fear of repercussions. Mm-hmm. And that really kind of like, drove my want to be in advocacy. And later in life now, within my adult career, became more confident in my own skin. So then I can then help others, that can hear from my own personal story, my own personal experiences. And if it can help somebody through their own journey, I'm all about it.
Fantastic. Elijah, how about you?
My name is Elijah. I am the program coordinator for LIVE. My pronouns are they, them. As program coordinator, I oversee things like the day-to-day execution of our program. I do coordination with our community partners across the state, event management, that sort of thing. And also I help to present and bring the community stories together and bring them to our platforms that we use here at Mental Health America of California. So a little bit of everything in a sense, but between Anthony and I, we coordinate the whole LIVE program.
Nice. And how did you get into this work?
I've been involved in nonprofit work since I graduated from the University of California, Santa Barbara in 2023. I started out working with California tribes because I'm a citizen of the El Dorado Band of Miwok Indians myself. And that was excellent work. We were doing land stewardship, land back work, but I in doing that work, it involved a lot of interfacing with forestry crews, which as you might imagine can be sort of the macho man, masculine type. And in doing that, I just was noticing over time that because of my identity, because of who I am, because of how I present, I wasn't feeling comfortable all the time. I wasn't feeling like I was getting the same amount of respect as my peers were, and it just felt like I was in the wrong place for me. It felt like I was having to choose between being myself and being effective. And I didn't really love that, so I started seeking exploring, opportunities to get involved with work in a more queer-friendly way. And then I happened across this position and went for
And voila, here you are. Excellent.
it.
Well, there's no doubt. I think all of our listeners are probably aware, at least to some degree, that mental health is really at a crisis level in so many aspects of our community, and especially with today's political climate, LGBT people and transgender people specifically are really feeling the squeeze.
Yes, definitely.
So give us a sense about the scope of the program. It's a California state program, but how specifically do you interface with the LGBT community?
Excellent, Greg. Thank you very much for that. This is a great opportunity for us to be able to paint a picture of like the state of California and how we are supporting nonprofit organizations throughout the five behavioral health districts, statewide. So first off, within our 14 partners that we work with, we have the Superior region, which is also known as Northern California, and we have our group in Chico, the Stonewall Alliance Center of Chico, who leads the Superior region in Northern California with their advocacy. And then moving on down the state of California, we have our Bay Area region. And within the Bay Area region, within like Napa, Sonoma County, San Francisco, we work with Positive Images, Vera at Drag Story Hour, and then also the San Francisco AIDS Foundation as well in the Bay Area. And then moving along down the map, we also are uplifting in the Central region. And within the Central region, we work with Mo Pride in Modesto. And then also here in Sacramento is the Sacramento LGBT Center. And then moving along down into Southern California, we have the Los Angeles region. And within the Los Angeles region, we partner with Reach LA and Impulse in Los Angeles County, as well as AIDS Healthcare Foundation, Los Angeles. And moving along down to Southern region, we work with North County LGBT Resource Center, Asian Mental Health Project, and then also the Library Foundation in San Diego, formerly known as the San Diego Public Library, AIDS Healthcare Foundation San Diego, Vietnamese American Arts and Letters Association, also known as VALA, and the Viet Rainbow of Orange County, also known as VROC.
Well, you have
And
quite a
throughout,
range.
yes, throughout all of these partners, we specifically chose to work with these partners because they all consist of change makers throughout the whole state of California, and they are uplifting their LGBTQ plus advocacy within their own regions, within their own communities. And we get a partner and help amplify those voices. And the way that we do that is hearing back from the community specifically in all these areas around any type of like policy, system, environment change that needs to happen within the community around accessing behavioral health care. And then also just building a stronger community within the LGBTQ plus platform throughout the whole state, because we are all about celebrating diversity and inclusivity. And then also throughout this program, it just gives the opportunity for community to live authentically, as well as having a voice in policy and systems and positive change towards accessing behavioral health and breaking down those barriers and the stigma that comes along with that as well.
Well, you mentioned Positive Images. They're here in Santa Rosa, which is where we are. Can you give us an example of how your organization interfaces or supports their work?
Of course, yes. And we will be getting into that as well throughout this conversation. But specifically with Positive Images, we're able to partner with Positive Images. In the past 2 years, we've been able to connect with Positive Images and their community members through our in-person empowerment circles, which is an opportunity for community to come to the table and for Positive Images to host in-person, like trust-building community event to where we're getting direct feedback from the community members around Sonoma County, Napa area, as well as the Bay Area. And through those empowerment circles, we're able to build a plan around the Live campaign within the Bay Area. And then In addition to the empowerment circles, we have work group meetings. And these work group meetings invite community in as well with Positive Images stakeholders, partners, and individuals in the community that they've built a relationship with to be able to help really shape their live campaign that drives that positive change towards the Bay Area specifically is education and getting providers knowledge about what the needs are of the community within the Positive Images area and Bay Area as well.
Mm-hmm. And I have to imagine that transgender people, the greater trans community and LGBT youth collectively, youth, really have had an increased need here in the last, well, certainly the last year, and then of course in the 2016 to 2020 period when there was so much oppression coming down from the federal level. Can you give us some examples about how you've been working to support the trans community and LGBT youth beyond what you just talked about with Positive Images?
Yeah, I could jump in here, Greg. So something that I think that's really cool about LIV that provides like a little bit of context for what I'm about to get into is that LIV's a very, as Anthony mentioned, community-based project. I think that often when it comes to these kinds of initiatives, it can sort of look like a group or organization coming into a community and saying, you know, this is a problem that we've identified with you guys. Here's how we're going to help you with it. Versus LIV, it's the entire first year of LIV was just community assessment. It's based entirely in going to the community and asking them, hey, like, what's going on? What are your biggest issues? What are you facing? And then together as a group, devising a strategy to address it. And so that's an integral part of LIV's approach. And so then when it comes to California, you know, it's huge. The experiences of queer folks up in Chico are going to be massively different from queer folks in the Bay Area, queer folks in Los Angeles, so on and so forth. And so in certain regions, we've had more participation, community turnout and participation from these, you know, subsects of the community, specifically within the central region. We have historically had great youth turnout at our empowerment circles, at our regional roundtables. And so that's mostly attributed to the fact that we work with the Sacramento LGBT Center, and they are a known youth, a known queer youth sort of safe haven. And so as a result of having so many youth present at these meetings where we're planning out these campaigns, the campaigns become directly shaped not only by the youth's issues that they're facing, but also by their priorities and by their values. And so in the central region, that became the Mental Health for All campaign. We were hearing a lot from the youth that the biggest issue was navigating insurance. You know, like you hit 20, 25, 21, depending on if you're in university or not, and you get kicked off of your parents' insurance. And it's a whole thing. And we were hearing from the youth that that's one of their biggest challenges. And so as a result, the campaign in the central area has become the Mental Health for All campaign with the intention of creating a directory that will help youth locate providers and, you know, be more easily able to access these things that they're having difficulties with. Mm-hmm. And then similarly with the trans community down in Los Angeles, our events have some really great turnout from trans and gender nonconforming individuals because our partner down in Los Angeles, Reach LA, is a huge central organization within the Vogue and Ballroom community. And Vogue and Ballroom is historically a very safe space, a very trans space, a very genderqueer space. And so, you know, similarly to the central region being shaped by youth priorities, the Los Angeles region's campaign has become very shaped by the priorities and concerns of the trans and gender non-conforming community. And so that has become the Mental Health Task Force initiative. And the aim is that it will create a group of peers that can provide behavioral health support to each other, specifically because a lot of trans and gender non-conforming folks were feeling like the supports that they were accessing, the people that were providing the supports, you know, they may have had like a little web training on how to work with trans people or how to use pronouns, but they didn't have the lived experience to back it up. And they were finding that they wanted something that more closely mirrored the structure of ballroom, which is a very familial structure, very mm-hmm. interdependent, mutually supportive. And so that, you know, developed naturally into the Mental Health Task Force. So It looks different in each region, but those two really come to mind when it comes to how we are interfacing with those parts of the community.
Sure, good examples. Well, I guess California's always sort of felt like it has supported and has prioritized mental health in general. But I've also read a lot about and witnessed a lot about dwindling funds, budget cuts, prioritizations, and of course, politics always falls into that as well. What's sort of your assessment about where California is in terms of supporting mental health in general, but specifically your work budget-wise, because none of this can happen without money.
Well, currently, right now, Greg, we are up against this. And it's real, it's today. Currently, the governor's May revision could potentially, if passed, cut $6.7 million from the community's advocacy budget. And that's huge for the LIV program. This would permanently eliminate all funding moving forward, and we're currently in year two, getting ready to roll into year three with all of the advocacy work that has been done statewide throughout our 14 partners within the LIV program. And if this does pass, this becomes effective July 1st of this year. And not only does it permanently eliminate all funding for our community advocacy, but it silences those voices. It erases what has been brought to the state level and legislative visits that we've been currently working on with our partners, taking each partner's advocacy and giving them space to be able to share how cutting this funding affects not only the constituents around the whole state of California, but the organizations, the partners that have been created through the LIV program. It completely affects the momentum moving forward around breaking the stigma around behavioral health, having affirming care providers educated on what the needs are of the population. And these grants are a vital component of the LIV program because it supports the community-based advocacy training throughout California that is created by the LGBTQ plus community through their own lived experiences. That way they can take that experience and create it and share it and educate the population and providers in a way that is accessible to everybody throughout the state of California.
And if I may jump in here, just to speak a little bit more, Greg, to the part of your question about, the current politics and the current directions and how that's affecting the work that we do. What we're seeing a lot across the state, in terms of the cuts that are being made, the revisions that are being made, the redistributions, is there seems to be a general attempt to move away from community-based models of support and to move towards more centralized models of support, which like almost any change on a legislature level, it sounds good in some ways and sounds bad in some ways. But what's especially concerning about this direction, these sorts of cuts being proposed, as Anthony spoke to, is that it's not only is it taking away from work that's already being done, but it's taking the work and putting it in the hands of bodies that aren't necessarily trusted by the community. Especially with regards to the trans parts of the community and the youth. Historically, the government hasn't always been the best to us. So it's there's a level of distrust there. And so it's important to have these community-based organizations that are sort of arbitrating and being the intermediary for this kind of work. And so these attempts to move it, with events like Prop 1 passing and this revise, with attempts to move it into this more centralized sort of state-based model, what we are anticipating is that it's going to leave folks with many more service gaps. It's going to leave folks feeling sort of abandoned and less likely to seek out services. And it's going to make the work more difficult ultimately, because if the work's already taking place in, programs like LIV, other programs across the state, then the foundations that we've already built, the platforms that we've already built, they kind of have to start from the ground up and do it in a way that's even less community-centered, which is, always disheartening to see as a community-based program like ours.
Yeah. Well, it's hard enough because LGBT people are largely invisible to begin with. And so if a person is feeling like they've had to retreat into the closet, they're going to be much less likely to trust a large state-level centralized organization, as you described, than they are a familiar face like someone might find at Positive Images. So, I
Right.
mean,
And
go
Greg,
ahead.
that's what we really saw in year one. In year one, when we came and met each of the community members in person through the empowerment circles, there were some walls up. It took a year to build that trust in every single region throughout the state of California. Some was hard just because of simply, like you had mentioned, in the past, feeling invisible, not seen, not heard. So here we go to come into each of our partners' communities and, let them know we're here to support. But it took a year to be able to gain that trust for them to then be like, okay, this is different. Let's go ahead and move forward.
So how can our listeners advocate on the behalf of the mental health needs of our community and specifically for the importance of your program? What would you like to see our listeners do?
Really reach out to our partners, figure out who are the advocates in their community. You can go to our website at mhac.org, and the LIV program page lists all 14 of our partners. Getting to know where they are at and what the advocacy is that they are doing, because with all the diversity of who we are able to partner with, you'll be able to find somebody that is fighting the fight that is specifically relatable to you. And the first step would be identifying who those organizations are, because we're able to connect with those organizations and help with educating the community on how to advocate. That's what's wonderful about our workshops that we have throughout the year with all of our partners. Is we're able to partner with the policy program here at Mental Health America of California and pair that with each LIV campaign and all the community members that show up to the empowerment circles, that show up to the work groups, that show up to the round tables. They're able to have access to that education to help support the advocacy that they're already doing, but may not know how to get connected to the people that make a difference on the decision maker level and the legislative staff. It really helps support the networking, developing your own campaign, creating a pitch, and also getting connected directly to those decision makers that can help support that advocacy that the community is wanting to learn more about.
That's great.
And to add on to that a little bit, I think that in terms of sort of like actionable, easy first steps that listeners can take, and this is one of those pieces of advice that's sort of repeated in all kinds of spaces and can sort of sound repetitive sometimes, but we really do recommend engagement with local bodies of decision making. Often when we think about politics and voting, especially I will say, being a younger person myself, folks in my generation, we sometimes only think about sort of that state level and higher of voting, only engaging with the general election or like maybe if you're lucky the Senate's. But when it comes to supporting programs like LIV, when it comes to supporting the implementation of behavioral health supports via community programs, it's really critical to engage with local bodies of decision making. Specifically, I'd advise listeners to seek out your local behavioral health board. That's usually a pretty easy thing to find. You just, for example, myself, us being based out of Sacramento County, I would just type in Sacramento Behavioral Health Board. And the cool thing is that these boards are made to serve the people, and so they do want to listen to you. And so once you find your local behavioral health board, it's likely you'll be able to, their website will guide you on how to participate in meetings, how to submit feedback, how to submit input. And that sort of thing really shapes how the implementation of how behavioral health funds are used throughout your county, throughout your jurisdiction. And then past that, engaging with, that next level of decision making, your local assembly member, your local Senate, you know, whoever represents your district, just typing in your county, finding out your district reps and reaching out to them and asking, you know, what are you doing about this? How are we doing this? Here's my concern. Writing letters, writing emails, making phone calls, all those things do make a difference because those bodies are made to listen and to incorporate that feedback. So I'd say that that's probably the single most impactful thing that listeners can do when it comes to supporting behavioral health implementation on a community program-based level.
Great. Make your voice known. Anthony,
Yes.
tell us one more time where people can go to learn more about the LIV program.
That would be at www.mhac.org. And once you get to our website, you can click on the LIV program page to where you can access all of our up-to-date information and community partners information as well.
We invite all listeners to come to our year three gathering that we'll be having October 5th up here in Sacramento. We get everybody together and do a not only a celebration of queerness, but we engage with advocacy on that workshop level. So to all of your dear listeners, we invite you and we'd love to see you there.
Awesome. And if you missed that website, we'll put it on our own website at outbeatnews.com. You can just click on show notes at the top of the page and you can check out what is available and how you can support them. Anthony
I
Elijah,
just
thank you so much for being part of our show today.
thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so
And
much, Greg. And thank you again, Greg, for hosting us at Outbeat News. And also, we would like to thank the Commission for Behavioral Health for always supporting the advocacy through the LIV program as well.
we'll be back with more right after this. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, our next guest is Charlie Stevens. He's a resident of Port Orford, which is located on the southern Oregon coast. They are the owner of Seawolf Books and Community Writing Center. Charlie's short fiction has appeared in Electric Literature, Best Small Fictions Anthology, New World Writing, Original Plumbing, Feminist Press, and a variety of other places. This month, Finn Dearheart had a chance to sit down with Charlie to hear more about their work.
Welcome to Outbeat News. I'm Finn Dearheart, and I'm super stoked today to speak with Charlie Stevens about their amazing books. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Thank you.
Yeah, Charlie's in their bookshop right now.
Yeah.
Hoping to hear all about the genesis and the evolution of the bookstore. Before we dive, let me just read a little quick bio on Charlie. Born and raised in Oregon, Charlie J. Stevens, they them, has lived and worked all over the United States as a bike messenger, wilderness guide, high school English teacher, and seasonal shark diver. Charlie's debut novel, A Wounded Deer Leaps Highest, was long listed for the Center for Fiction's first novel prize and was a finalist for the Oregon Book Awards. In 2025, it was awarded the Leslie Feinberg Award in Trans and Gender Variant Literature and the Bronze Forward Indies Award for LGBTQ plus fiction. A resident of Port Orford on the southern Oregon coast, Charlie is the owner of Seawolf Books and Community Writing Center. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you so much.
Totally. I love having writers come speak with us on Outbeat News. We're like trying to expose people in the Bay Area to amazing writing. I've just really loved your writing and appreciate you being willing to talk about it. I know you just put out this story, the short stories book, Annihilation for Beginners.
Yeah.
Which my listeners won't be able to see the book. I won't be able to show the cover right now, but it's an amazing collection of short stories. And I'm curious to hear a little bit about how writing short stories allows you as a narrator or as a writer to inhabit all these different narrative perspectives. It's really
yeah.
cool. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. What's that like to be able to just, because what I'll say, I'll kind of preface my question. It's like reading from it, like the narrator being I, and then all the different characters in the book, which is really cool because usually when I'm reading a book, the I would be a continuous narrator, but it's getting to almost like this fractalized or many different facets of a writer.
Yeah, I love short stories for that reason. I mean, I really, I don't know if I mean, I'm working on a second novel, so I guess I am going to keep doing this to myself, but but short stories are really what I love writing the most. Like, I think they're like incredibly fun. Like you were saying, I love the way that you can kind of inhabit different worlds for short amounts of time. And it, yeah, you just get to explore different, I guess, parts of myself and then also different parts of, yeah, other lives and other realities.
That's what I really appreciate, how there's such a it's like this organic quality to the writing, in which I get, you know, it's like being in nature in a sense. Like, I know that that's really important to you as a writer, but also not just like the things that are really like nice to look at in nature, but like the beauty and the terror all together. I found in your writing in the novel as well as in Annihilation for Beginners, and found that to be really exciting. Curious to hear more about your relationship with nature.
I mean, nature saved me, and was definitely a refuge when I was young, and still now. I mean, it's changed. My relationship to it has changed somewhat, but it's always been a place that's kind of welcomed me and felt like home, I guess. And yeah, it does contain everything. I mean, there's so much beauty and there's so much death in nature as well. And I think that's kind of partially why I'm drawn to it. Like, it encompasses everything.
Totally. I mean, that's my sense too. You know, I go out walking on the beach with my dogs almost every morning. And I get obsessed about taking pictures of like just dead things that I find. And sometimes there's like plants growing up in the middle of them. And there's this, it's just woven together in a way that's not separate in the ways that human lives and consciousness is already in a kind of separateness. And so when I was reading your work, I could feel that in the characters. Even like in the novel, if you talk about the novel, A Wounded Deer Leaps Highest, a little bit, that narrator, which is eating dirt, or they were eating dirt, it just felt so like this child is so integrated in a way that if another human walked by, they might be like, what are you doing? But it made so much sense to them. And yeah, just kind of curious to hear about your relationship with that narrator too in that in the novel.
In the novel, I mean, I feel like Smokey is very permeable. I guess that's a word that I would use to describe them. And yeah, that, the eating the dirt, that was a way for them to kind of ground, literally ground into stability in a way. And and then just kind of like being permeable in general, like, and that's kind of what we were just talking about, like the welcoming in the beauty and the darkness. And I mean, that novel is, that's kind of what I was trying to do throughout the whole thing, like with the other characters as well. Like, yeah, we can't be just all one thing.
Right.
And yeah. So just kind of thinking about that. And then, yeah, I mean, that's a kid who was like very close to trees and very close to the ground and very close to plants and animals. And yeah, it's kind of an encompassingness.
Encompassing, that word is that really, to me, that really speaks to how they live. I wonder if that too, if there's something of Smokey's transness being in outside of the really structural ways that even the people in their life was were, being in that might be part of the way that they're on the outside of that and being able to see the folly of the humans around them, and just feeling like I don't quite fit in this world that these people, and especially too with the, just the traumatic world that they're in. Does that
I mean, it's like we, many of us live, we have our own internal experiences and then live in this world of like such strict binaries. And yeah, I mean, in that novel, I mean, like so many novels, it's like this question of like, quote unquote, good and bad, and how there's really, there's no separating those things. But yeah, with gender, I mean, Smokey's only eight during the novel, and definitely noticing their own difference. And yeah, I think like going back to the nature thing, like just the, yeah, the encompassing aspect of what it means to have a gender or not, and what it means to inhabit space, whether that's nature or in a home or depending on who you're with and all those aspects.
Yeah, also Smokey, there's something about being in the child's point of view where, like children come into the world and adults, I'm generalizing massively, I don't have children, but it's like there's this, we need to raise you and teach you how the world works, quote unquote, when it's like really, there's this really special perspective that children inhabit that is. It's kind of this like cusp of what's possible and what's real and kind of in the, in their imagination, they have so much more room to kind of move into a greater sense of possible reality. And then adults are trying to curtail that. And so there's something about the child being the one who has the wisdom or the perspective or the insight that felt like that really came through for me reading the book.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I feel like children, I mean, they're so present with what's actually happening. I think there's something that occurs as we age that, I mean, there's probably millions of reasons, but yeah, there's something about kids, like being around kids or being a child, that it's, you're very much in your present moment and you have your imagination and you reflect on things that have happened and you can think about the future, but there's just a real sense of embodying like exactly what is, I think. And it was kind of the novel started out as a short story that just kept going. Like I couldn't put it down. I thought I had finished it. It got published in a literary magazine, and usually that's when I'm like, okay, I can stop. Like, I really need to stop now. And that one I just couldn't let go of. And I asked writer friends, like, is this a, can you stick with a present tense child narration for more pages? And they all said yes. So, but it was tricky. It was like a little taxing in a way.
How so? Tell me more.
I think it was about, I mean, it's about the, it was about the present tense. There is a limit to that. It's kind of hard to explain. And then as a child as well, I was just really trying to stick with like sensory feelings and what was happening in the moment. There wasn't a lot of like future projecting or past reflecting. It was just, it took effort to like stay right there. And yeah, it was challenging. I got a little bit like weary. But you know, I kept coming back to like this, it's hard because that's what it's like to be a kid. And it was an interesting experience for sure.
I feel like that really comes through this kind of well, very present.
Yeah.
And sometimes, there would be this moment where again, just referencing the novel for those who are listening. Well, also, I feel like this is comes through in the short stories too, but in this, because there was a short story in Annihilation for Beginners that was also the narrator from Wounded Deer Lipsius.
Yeah.
And I kind of was like reading along, I was like, wait, I've read this, but I could have
You're
had
like, I
this.
know
Like,
this
but
one.
it's also kind of a different, like, different angle
Yeah.
on the story. It was not just a repetition. But what was I gonna say about this though? Is that this, oh, sometimes, in Smokey, the narrator, the child narrator, it was almost like there was this, is this the retrospective kind of voice? Because this child is very, very wise. And kind of being like, this child knows so much, but there would just be this moment. I thought, I would wonder, is like, is that Charlie just inserting a little bit of a something that Charlie wants us to take away from the book as a reader, and as a writer, I'm kind of playing with this too myself, 'cause, like how much is revealed in the moment versus like, I just want you to just take this one little thing.
Yeah, there's actually Alexander Chee, I'm forgetting what he called it, but there's a name for it that he knows, where it's like an un you're presenting the kid in their present, but with more awareness as the author. And it was, I think that was kind of what I was saying earlier about like, weary isn't the right word, but it was a challenge to, I think, stick with that and figure out ways to kind of insert like a little bit broader of a perspective without it taking away from the reader's experience.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't take away from my experience ever. It just felt like, oh, there's like some wisdom here. And I just had this sense, and I was like, I think this is one of the points that I should be carrying away as a reader from the book. And I'm curious if you, as the writer, have any wishes for people as they read these books, what you, and maybe you don't, but like, is there something that you want them to take away and maybe be changed in some way by the work?
That's a good question. I don't know. Once the book is out for me, I'm like, it's not even mine anymore. Like, I want people to just do with it what they will. But I think, in general, for better or for worse, I'm a person who makes almost all my decisions, like writing and otherwise, based on feelings, very feeling driven. So I guess my hope would be that people feel things.
Well, I think that, yes, and I think that will absolutely happen if you read these books. I felt so much, actually. I'm excited to just, I actually want the novel itself, A Wounded Deer Leaps Highest, really sat with me for several days. I won't get into all the reasons right now, but it just has been in me, kind of working on me and in me. And there's this process that I'm going through in my own self around my own way of seeing myself as a cis person and just something, and it just really has set in me. And I think that's really all I can say is it's acting on me in a way. And I love it when a book does that, where I'm like, oh, I don't know what this is, but it's stimulating a process. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. That's, I guess, my hope and dream.
Yeah. I saw it on Instagram. I loved what I saw this picture, which we'll put your Instagram in the show notes, but of a desk sitting on the edge of the woods. Can you share a little bit about that? I love that.
Oh my God. I, through a series of miracles, bought 9 acres on a river on the coast, southern Oregon coast, and built a little cabin there. And yeah, it's just like the cabin is so, it's basically like a tiny little shack. So I had to get the desk out of there. So it's just sitting in this kind of open area. And I'm hoping to do some writing there. But the other thing about the Oregon coast is there's lots of mosquitoes. So it's gonna be just like a bloodbath. It's okay. It's gonna be worth it.
That. It was so cool to see, though. I thought, wow, I really should try something like that sometime.
Yeah, it's fun to experiment, especially living. I live very rurally, and you know, I go to Portland and it's like, oh my God, I could sit in a cafe and write. It's so exciting now. And here it's like, oh, sometimes my writing studio is like in my truck, like
Oh,
parked on
wow.
the edge of the ocean. Sometimes it's, you know, at a desk outside, or you know, it's a different kind of place to be.
Do you write every day, or do you have a kind of a punctuated flow that comes in and out? Like, what's your style like?
I do write every day. I definitely journal every day, and then yeah, I'm not too disciplined, but I typically want to.
Yeah.
So it happens. Yeah.
I always feel like I have a hard time doing it every single day, but then we'll go into these stints where just get obsessed and can't get out of it, you
Yeah.
know? And then I'm like,
Yeah.
oh, get really irritable with just anything in my life that starts to interrupt me.
Totally. Yeah,
Yeah.
I get that too. It's the best feeling that like that just like when that's all you want to do. There's nothing better than that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to have you share a little bit with the listeners about the bookshop, the genesis of that for you, and any ways that like our listeners with Outbeat could help support the store.
Yeah, it's very small. It's like very small. It's been interesting. I think the size has made it so like every book I have carefully chosen, so it feels like well curated for what I like. And it's interesting, like sometimes people come in and I can tell, you know, they come in and are like take a deep breath and walk right back out.
Really?
Yeah, and I have something on Instagram for the bookstore, that it's like how many days, you know, like in like stores and whatever, they have a sign of like how many days without an accident. I
No,
noticed
no.
it's like, yeah, 0 or like 20 days since the last accident for OSHA or whatever. And in the bookstore, it's like how many days since someone last asked me for a Bible.
Oh, wow. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
At this point, it's
It's
funny, but
rural Oregon,
it's been
yeah.
a little bit disorienting. But mostly, though, what's cool is people come in and they're like, "Oh my God, you have all my favorite books!" And they get so excited to talk to me about which books they've read. And I think it makes them also more, you know, interested in like asking for recommendations. I don't know. It's really great. Yeah.
I'm surprised about the Bible, piece.
It's very conservative here. I mean, this town is very strange, Port Arford. It's on the sign, it says the population is like 1,100, but that is not, that cannot be right. There's like, there, I would say 800 full
Oh,
time, and most of those people don't come out of the forest. It's just
so
like
funny.
70 of us actually interacting. But yeah, there are a lot of artists here, and there's a lot of readers and thinkers, and it's also yeah, like a tiny pocket of kind of leftist ishness in a sea of red. So yeah, it's and I like that. I feel good about living in a place where people don't think the same and conversations are required. But yeah, in the bookstore, especially with what's happening politically right now, it's been a little bit, I've been more nervous maybe than usual, but it's been good.
Is there a way that people could order books from Seawolf Books and
Yeah, there's just through Bookshop, which is such a great organization
I
that
love it,
partners
yeah.
with indie bookstores. That's probably the best way.
Bookshop.org.
Yeah, and then yeah, then Seawolf Books.
Super cool. Is there anything else before we conclude that you want our listeners at Outbeat to hear or to know about you, about your writing, about the store?
I'm just really happy that I feel like something's happening with people are understanding the importance of being readers and reading widely and experiencing things through literature. And maybe that's always been true, but I feel like in these times, like it's so important to read widely. And I guess I would just encourage people to keep doing that.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wholly agree with that and appreciate that as well. Thank you all for listening at Outbeat, and we will put the links in the show notes for you to check out Charlie's work, their bookstore, and also we'll put bookshop.org there in the notes. And I highly recommend reading both A Wounded Deer Leaps Highest and also Annihilation for Beginners. And I'll look forward to talking next month.
And that wraps up our hour. Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Grayer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com.
I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to. So I give it up to you. Oh. You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter. I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Ooh.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County, with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Rohnert Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Beale Street Caravan is next.